I see you have done your homework. I am nothing if not thorough. He smiles and in the process sheds a layer of formality. Am I also right in believing that your six-month stay at Ilton expires next week? Yes. And do you have anywhere to go after that? I always figure something out, Prince... Frederick. Please, I asked you to call me Frederick. He pulls a single piece of paper, folded lengthwise, from the pocket inside his finely woven navy suit coat. I believe that if you will be so kind as to humor my brother-in-law with answers to his questions, that I can be of great assistance with your next move. Is that so? Indeed, I have good friends who have offered to place you in an apartment here in Hanover, near the Marstall Gate. It's a lovely part of the city. A home of your own for as long as you need it. And all I have to do is answer a few questions? Prince Ernest Frederick of Saxe-Altenburg hands her the paper, along with his pen. It is truly as simple as that.
Chapter 12. Anastasia. The Governor's House. 1917. Tobolsk, Russia. August 7th. We arrive at our new home to find it uninhabitable. We decide in the end that Kerensky chose the old governor's house because it was the single dwelling in all of Tobolsk that could be accessed by a wooden walkway from the dock. A small mercy given the channels of mud that serve as streets and alleys in this godforsaken Siberian outpost. From the dock we march under military escort along a narrow boardwalk, passing astonished locals until we reach the two-story clapboard building. "I don't understand," Mother says, staring aghast at the boarded windows and littered porch. "What is this place?" Leshy pulls the red kerchief from his pocket and wipes the sweat from his brow. He nods toward the abandoned building.
"The governor's house. Your new home."
"Kerensky said we'd be in a mansion."
"I suspect you hear what you want to hear, Alexandra. There are no mansions in Tobolsk."
The governor's house is large, but it is not elegant, nor is it clean, hygienic, or livable, not after being used for several years as an army barracks. We stand there, gaping at the open front door and the dank rooms beyond. After several minutes, a stray cat wanders out, takes one look at Jimmy, in crouched position with hackles raised, and bolts up the nearest tree with a furious screech. I lunge for Jimmy and grab him by the collar to stop him from chasing after it, stumbling forward several steps with his momentum. The interior of the house looks no better than the exterior. Mud, an inescapable reality in Tobolsk, has been tracked over every inch of the floor. I am certain that my hem and shoes will never be the same. There is not a single curtain on the windows, but the panes are intact. They are so filthy that I can scrape off a layer of grime with my fingernail.
"You cannot expect us to live here," Mother says, holding a scented kerchief over her nose. "It is foul."
Leshy stands just inside the door, arms behind his back.
"It is your new home. Make of it what you will."
We continue our tour through the squalid rooms, stunned and demoralized. The air is heavy and damp and smells of cat urine and bad plumbing. I turn the tap inside the first floor bathroom and a weak stream of brown water spurts against the chipped enamel sink. Behind us, the soldiers trudge in never-ending lines with our trunks and cases, dropping them to the floor without any sort of order.
"What do we do?" Mother groans, turning in a small circle as she takes in the crumbling plaster walls and endless cobwebs.
As a lady's maid, Dover has never once picked up a broom or a dusting cloth in all the years she was at Alexander Palace. But that does not stop her from taking one shaky breath and assuming control.
"We clean it," she says simply, then begins making order out of chaos.
Dr. Botkin and Cook are dispatched to the city for cleaning supplies, while Dover strong-arms the closest group of soldiers to help with the windows.
"Open them," she orders, sticking a plump finger in each of their faces. "Get the air moving again."
The boys are young, barely older than I am, pink-cheeked and too intimidated to argue. The windows, swollen with humidity, are forced upward with brittle wines, and then the boards are pried from where they've been nailed to the outside of the house. Once the light gets in, we can see exactly what needs to be done. Dover, God bless her, doesn't allow us to crumble beneath the weight of this realization.
"One room," she says, fists clenched and voice peppered with flint. "We get one room clean enough to sleep in tonight. This one will do, in fact."
We look around us at what was likely a study and nod feebly. Dover grabs Thomas as he passes. He has just set down a trunk against the wall and is on his way out to pull another off one of the many carts lined up outside the house.
"You,"
she says.
"What is your name?"
"Thomas."
"How old are you?"
17.
So young, so very young to pick up a rifle and be a soldier. Dover is one of those people who decides instantly and irrevocably whether she likes someone. Something about the boy must appeal to her because she says,
"It is now your job to help me find everything we need. Do you understand?"
Thomas shocks us all by smiling. In addition to those dimples, he's also in possession of high cheekbones and pretty teeth. I can't tell the color of his eyes beneath the brim of his cap, but I find myself suddenly curious about them.
"I'd be happy to,"
he says.
"Then I suppose you'll be happy to help us scrub the house as well."
"I have 7 brothers,"
Thomas says.
"I've scrubbed worse."
We sleep on our camp beds that night. The windows are open and the mosquitoes are relentless, but at least the fresh air helps ease the scent of men and cats and things we are afraid to name. But we sleep. And when morning comes, we're better able to face the task of making the house, this prison, into a home. We get to work immediately. Since my family is forbidden to leave the grounds, Dover and Botkin go in shifts, led by Thomas, to purchase everything from washstands to curtains to candles. The most appreciated acquisition, however, is a laundress. By the time we've scrubbed all the floors, walls and windows on the first floor, our hands are bleeding and chapped, our clothing filthy. The thought of plunging my hands into one more bucket of water, even to wash my underclothes, is enough to make me abandon all hope. Despite the grimness of our situation, we discover that Tobolsk does have a certain beauty. The Irtysh River is wide and muddy, but at sunset it looks like a winding golden ribbon trimmed with bright marshy fringe. We sit on the second floor balcony after dinner, listening to Father read aloud. The air is balmy, and crickets serenade us from the grass. While Father regales us with the adventures of Sherlock Holmes, I stare at the white stone Kremlin high on the hill and the cathedral in the middle of town. Such beautiful, elaborate buildings in such a distant, drab outpost. Apart from these two impressive monuments, the only other point of interest in Tobolsk is a museum that Thomas says is used to display various torture devices.
"It's grotesque,"
he explained that afternoon while discreetly feeding a bit of crust to Jimmy in the yard. My traitorous dog has developed an alarming attachment to the boy, and it is all I can do to keep him from padding after Thomas constantly.
"They've got branding irons and shackles, and this thing, I don't know what it's called, that pulls the bone in your nose right out of the skull."
"You've been here before?"
"This is where I was born."
He laughed at my stunned expression and says,
"Everyone comes from somewhere, Anastasia."
Thomas pointed toward the museum.
"My oldest brother dragged me there as punishment for telling our mother that I'd seen him kissing a girl on the boardwalk. The lesson, I believe, was that I learned to keep a secret."
"And did it work?"
"I was so frightened, I had nightmares for a month."
"I mean, did you learn to keep secrets?"
"I'd sooner have my own nose bone removed than reveal one ever again,"
he told me with a grin, and I saw then that his eyes are a bright and pretty blue. 7 weeks later, Tobolsk, Russia, September 27th.
We are summoned to Father's study the first night it snows in Tobolsk. The air was pleasant earlier in the day, but a sudden brutal wind rushed in from the north after breakfast. It was raining by lunch, and a thin dusting of snow covered the ground by dinner. We find our parents sitting beside the fireplace with Alexei, who is already asleep on a couch. The lamps are lit, the curtains drawn tight, and a large wooden chest lies in the middle of the floor.
"Come in,"
Father says.
"Let's read."
He puts a bit of straw into the fire and uses it to light his pipe. After taking two quick puffs, he motions for us to lock the door. Once Olga slides the bolt, Father licks the pad of his thumb, turns a page, and begins reading from the Musgrave Ritual, a bit louder than necessary.
"An anomaly which often struck me in the character of my friend Sherlock Holmes was that, although in his methods of thought he was the neatest and most methodical of mankind, and although also he affected a certain quiet primness of dress, he was nonetheless, in his personal habits, one of the most untidy men that ever drove a fellow lodger to distraction."
There is a difference between acting a story and reading a story, and though the difference is subtle, Father has mastered it beautifully. There is a richness of voice and command of language that a good reader employs, a cadence that is hard to teach. There is a rhythm and flow and a certain clip to the hard consonants, matched by softness with the short vowels. It's all in the vocal tone, and a bad reader will put you to sleep in moments, while a good reader will keep you rapt and desperate for more, even if you haven't seen a warm bed in a fortnight. I am so immediately transfixed by the sound of his voice that I don't realize they have called us in here for a different reason altogether. Mother sets a finger to her lips and motions for us to sit on the rug. We obey and watch in confusion as she places a sewing kit in each of our laps. "Watch me," she whispers, "and do as I do." Beside her chair is the basket of corsets I noticed weeks ago at the palace, and she hands them out to us without explanation. Mother opens the trunk in the middle of the room, folds back a piece of blue velvet, and reveals a small portion of the jewels I saw on my birthday. Instinctively, my hands drift to my earlobes and feel for the studs I chose as my present. Mother lifts a diamond bracelet from the trunk and returns to her seat. She lays the corset flat across her lap and places the bracelet into one of the seams she has so painstakingly ripped open. Mother looks at us in turn, silently, threads her needle, and places the point against the seam. With slow, deliberate movements, she begins to sew the bracelet inside the corset with tiny, precise stitches. "I am so glad," she says, "that you have mastered your needlework, girls. We have so much mending to do." Her meaning is clear, so we pick up our needles and get to work. Anyone listening at the door would simply hear Father reading and Mother commending our sewing. They would never guess the truth, that we sit before a warm fire sewing jewels into our corsets as the snow begins to come down in earnest beyond the walls of our little prison.
Chapter 13. Anna. The Copenhagen Statement. 1931-1930. Four Winds Sanatorium, Westchester County, New York. July 1931. Decades later, when Anna thinks about the year and a half she spent living in the Manhattan penthouse of Annie Burr Jennings, she will feel as if she's looking at her own life from a great height, like an eagle circling above, peering with intensity at objects that are hundreds of feet away. Each of these objects, the loss of one parrot and the death of another, a night at the Metropolitan Opera, skinny dipping on Sconset Beach, a bottle of champagne tumbling then shattering on the sidewalk, lunch at the Ritz-Carlton, and Edward Fallows's ridiculous idea for the Grand Danore Corporation, are viewed as separate from the whole, moments clipped out and set against a larger swathe of time, like silver foil against black velvet. Those memories, however, are currently eclipsed by the way her stay is coming to an end. She sits in the admissions office of the Four Winds Sanatorium, being discharged 1 long year after being admitted. The thing about being an inconvenience, Anna thinks, is that you're easy to lock away. And if they call you insane or mentally unstable, or, God forbid, crazy, they can toss away the key without feeling a shred of guilt. Annie Burr Jennings did so with alarming ease last July, and Anna suspects that she would not find herself being released from the sanatorium even now if this new doctor, she has not even bothered to acquire his name, had not taken over the institution earlier this month and ordered evaluations on every patient housed here. She owes her emancipation to him. "This woman is no more insane than I am," the doctor says, laying his clipboard down on his desk. "She is clearly upset and undeniably paranoid, but she does not belong in an asylum for the mentally insane. You need to make other arrangements for her." The doctor looks not at Anna, but at her former host, Annie Burr Jennings, or, as Anna has thought of her since their acquaintance, the heiress. "This woman has a long history of psychotic behavior. I should know. She lived with me for 18 months and frequently blacked out, threw things, and locked herself in her room. And if that is not enough, she even concocted a fraudulent scheme with the intent of embezzling money from my friends. At least 3 of them fell for it before I caught wind of what was happening," the heiress says, also avoiding eye contact with Anna. "Arrangements have been made. Miss Anderson will return to Germany aboard the Deutschland in 2 days' time. Her ticket has already been purchased." So it has come to this, Anna thinks. Miss Anderson. A demotion. It wasn't so long ago that the heiress was calling her Anastasia, or in one of her more generous moments, Your Majesty. "I do not want to return to Germany," Anna says. "I want to speak with Gleb Botkin." At this pronouncement, the heiress finally turns to address her. Anna is startled to see that the once friendly gaze is now harder, almost cruel. "Haven't you spoken with him during your stay?" "No. He has neither called nor visited, and as I'm sure you know, I have not been allowed to initiate contact." A pity. I think it's safe to assume that if Mr. Botkin has not reached out to you, it is because he does not want to." She turns back to the doctor. "I am disappointed to hear that you do not agree with the diagnosis of my family physician. He believes this woman to be quite insane." "And I find it concerning that there's no record of his exam, either physical or psychological, in her file." "I believe that exam was performed in his private office. You would have to contact him for those documents." The doctor leans back in his chair and shifts his gaze between the two women. "I see. Well, by the time Miss Anderson reached us, she was quite sedate, and she has remained so during her stay." "A stay I have paid for," the heiress says, "at quite significant financial cost." "We are not a cheap institution. We are not run by the government. I assume that is why you chose our facility for your friend."
"I chose it for your reputation and your discretion."
This last word is stressed in such a way that Anna begins to fear there are strings attached to her release. The heiress's voice is calm and measured, almost pleasant, as she continues,
"As you will see from your records, I have paid over $25,000 for Miss Anderson's care. At my request, she was placed in your best room, a 4-room suite, in fact, and given a personal attendant. I have spared no expense for her care and treatment. Wouldn't you agree?"
His eyes narrow. "Yes."
"And would you also agree that such an investment in the mental health of a woman, someone who is not my blood relation, during the extreme financial crisis our country is currently experiencing, is an act of extraordinary grace and kindness on my part?"
"You are quite benevolent," he says dryly.
"And so humble," Anna adds, but neither of them acknowledges the interruption.
The heiress leans a bit closer and holds out her withered, jewel-laden hand palm up.
Then you will understand that I require all of her medical records to be turned over to me immediately. I'm sorry, madam, I cannot. This will, of course, include every detail of her treatment, a list of any visitors, and, most important, all notes and files acquired from my personal physician. What you are asking is against the law. Her hand does not waver. I'd be happy to bring the law into this if that's what you want, but before we take such drastic measures, you may want to have your accountant look at your books. I think you will find that I paid more to this institution than any other account this year, she says, as though the issue of mental health were a simple business transaction. The heiress lets this settle in before she makes her final, most potent threat. And you may also want to check the plaque beside the front door of your institution. You will see my father's name engraved at the top. He was on your board of directors, and he was the largest beneficiary Four Winds has ever had. The trust he set up before his death still keeps the lights on here. The doctor looks at Anna, and then at the inch-thick file on his desk. What will happen to this young woman when she is returned to Germany? That is not your concern, doctor. She reaches her hand forward again. The file, please. And just like that, any proof Anna might have, anything she might be able to use in her defense later, is surrendered, no doubt to be destroyed by Annie Burr Jennings. 1 year earlier. Private Medical Office, Manhattan. July 25th, 1930. Madness is as madness does. And though some would consider it pure insanity to cradle a dead parrot, to Anna this act makes perfect sense. How else will she remember her pair of Januses? She lost the first parrot some time ago, and the second has been crippled ever since, unable to fly, destined to spend the rest of its life hopping about the furniture and scooting around the floor. It's no wonder she stepped on it. When the poor thing got caught in the folds of her heavy robe, Anna never saw it, never felt it until her bare foot snapped its fragile little neck. A tiny crunch, no more than the breaking of a twig. A final outraged squawk, and then silence. Anna picked up the bird, but its head lolled sideways at a grotesque angle. No, no, no. She shook the bird, but it nodded feebly, insisting that it was, in fact, dead. This was many hours ago, and she has been moaning pitifully ever since, refusing food and company, ignoring the urgent pounding on her bedroom door. In the quiet, rational part of her mind, Anna knows that she must pull herself together. She knows Janus was only a bird, or, to be exact, a pair of birds. She knows the last few years have taken their toll, and she admits, to herself at least, that she has looked to the bottle far too often to soothe her nerves and her sorrow. But this death, this small death, is one too many. And that creeping darkness that she has fought for over a decade begins to smother her again. It comes as it always does, with a blurring at the edge of her vision. A tightness in her chest. Shallow breaths, heavy limbs, and violent, unwanted memories that assault her mind, that fly at her unbidden and unexpected, tingling in her extremities, dizziness, and then a sense of panic and fear so deep she begins to scream and pull at her hair. There is chaos in the penthouse, and then a splintering of her bedroom door. It takes a moment to make sense of the loud, destructive chopping of a pair of fire axes. The heavy North American walnut is no match for the orderlies and their thick, trunk-like arms, their single-minded tenacity. 8 whacks, maybe 10, it's hard to count with the thunder in her ears, and the door rips apart. Anna howls again and scoots backward against the floor until she is pressed against the footboard of her bed, Janus in the crook of her arm. The men make soothing noises as they ease toward her. And the last thing Anna remembers before sliding into total darkness is a white jacket dangling from one large, knuckled hand. It has comically long sleeves and an alarming number of belts and buckles.
Where am I? Anna asks when she wakes sometime later. Her voice is heavy and inarticulate. Her tongue feels thick, like a piece of saddle leather, and she can't form the proper syllables. She sounds drunk. No, she sounds medicated. Even in this semi-conscious state, she remembers what this feels like. Anna bends her will to the simple act of forming three clear words. Where am I? Somewhere above her, a calm male voice answers.
Westchester.
Anna clears her throat, tries to force her eyes open, but there is only a murky purple sort of light. Several minutes of confusion and looming panic pass before she realizes there is a mask over her face. 30 seconds more before she feels the restraints. She is pinned to a padded reclined chair at several points along her body. Ankles, knees, waist, forearms, chest, shoulders, chin, and forehead. Anna can move nothing but her fingers. As the sedation slowly drains from her bloodstream, she fights the desire to give way to hysteria. Instead, she breathes slowly through her nose, in and out, until she is certain she can ask the next question without crying. Where am I exactly? Again that cool, disinterested voice. This time there is the scratching of pen against paper as well.
My office.
Why?
You have been given over to my care. After I collect a bit of data, I will have you transferred to the Four Winds Sanatorium.
She wants to ask this brisk, invisible man why she's being committed, what the medical grounds are for this decision. But none of these words or their tricky syllables make themselves available to the lethargic lump of muscle that is her tongue. All she can manage again is,
why? It has been determined that you have disordered nerves.
Anna cannot remember seeing a doctor or being examined by one, and she tries to tell this man as much, but her argument is garbled and nonsensical, even to her, when it tumbles slurred and ungainly from her mouth.
Calm down, Miss Anderson, a warm hand on her cheek. We're going to give you a treatment to calm your nerves. It is experimental, you understand, but we expect it to become the leading cure for depressive disorders such as yours in the coming decade.
Anna groans and tries to shake her head. She wants water and a bed and a cool, dark room, not whatever cure this man has concocted. He ignores her protest.
Because this treatment is new and under study, we will need your permission to administer it.
No. This word comes out perfectly clear, forced between her clenched teeth. The restraint that binds her forearms is loosened slightly, and a pen is set between the thumb and forefinger of her right hand. It is held by this man's hand, and he guides the pen across a piece of paper she cannot see. She can only hear the scratch, scratch, scratch as he forges her signature.
There, he says, with the first hint of inflection in his voice. Now we can continue. I appreciate your cooperation and can assure you it is not misplaced. Let me explain the procedure I am about to perform.
Anna tries to lash out with her arms, but the strap is yanked tight again, and she gasps as the leather digs into the bare skin of her forearms.
You are sitting in a device known as a Bergonic chair, he says. As you are aware, you are strapped down, but this is for your own safety. We have found that some patients do not respond well to the electric current, and they twitch, especially as the voltage is increased.
Whatever resolve Anna has previously maintained to keep the panic at bay quickly melts at this pronouncement. It is hard to scream, and the restraints make it impossible for her to thrash about, so she begins to moan instead. There is an almost gleeful note to his voice as he continues.
I have found in my research with soldiers during the Great War that electric treatment for psychological disorders is quite effective. I believe you will have a greatly improved disposition going forward.
No.
Oh, don't be so negative. I think you and Miss Jennings will be quite happy with the results.
There is a slight tugging at each of her restraints as he checks to make sure they are tight. Then he bends low near her ear and says,
Now this shouldn't hurt very much. At least not at first. We will begin with a low voltage. Like so many of the things doctors have told Anna through the years, it is a lie. 6 months earlier. Manhattan. January 14th, 1930. For us, the nearest relatives of the Tsar's family, it is very difficult and painful to reconcile ourselves to the fact that not a single member of that family is still alive. How gladly we would like to believe that one of them, at least, had survived the murderous destruction of 1918. We would shower our love on the survivor. But in the case of the lady in question, our sense of duty compels us to state that the story is only a fairy tale. The memory of our dear departed would be tarnished if we allowed this fantastic story to spread and gain credence. The statement was written almost 2 years ago, less than 24 hours after the death of the Dowager Empress, but it is reprinted in the Evening Post that day, along with a less than flattering article about Anna and her claims. The paper is brought to her on a silver tray, along with her lunch, by the heiress's butler. In time, the declaration will come to be known as the Copenhagen Statement. But that day it simply feels like another slap in the face. By that evening, after Anna has drunk an entire bottle of champagne, it feels like a declaration of war. Anna refuses to leave her room all afternoon, despite repeated summonses by the heiress. Preparations are underway for an intimate cocktail party to be held in the penthouse that evening, and Anna's opinion on the flower arrangements is desired. Or so they've said every time they've pounded on her bedroom door. Anna knows that in reality they are simply trying to draw her out of this lingering melancholy, trying to coax her into forgetting that infuriating statement. Anna didn't take the news any better when Gleb showed it to her the first time, and she has no intention of being docile about it now, either. Instead of letting them in, she turns up the volume on her phonograph and opens the window. There is a ferocious bite to the mid-January air, but she's wearing an ankle-length fur coat, albeit with nothing underneath, and the champagne gives her an illusion of warmth. The tip of her nose is soon cold, and her cheeks are red, but still she stands there, persisting in the stubborn act of sending puffs of frozen breath out the window. Behind her the birds squawk in their cage, beating their bright green wings against the thin metal bars. Anna sets the empty champagne bottle on the window ledge and turns to face them. "I'm sorry, pets. Have I not fed you today? I can't remember." The parrots usually eat a seed blend she buys at the exotic pet store down the street, but they also love fruit, apples in particular. At the moment, however, she has nothing in the room but the dried end of a toasted baguette that came with her lunch, and it will have to do for now. Why she opens the cage before she has closed the window, Anna cannot explain. Perhaps the champagne has clouded her senses, or maybe it's seeing the Romanov betrayal again. Regardless, the deed is done, and before she has time to react, both parrots launch from their confines and shoot like arrows toward the open window. "No!" Anna screams. She hears something large drop and then shatter in the other room. Cursing. The frantic beat of wings as both parrots fly perpendicular toward the window. They are separated by a mere 6 inches, one above the other. Someone pounds on her bedroom door. One parrot crashes into the window pane. The other glides smoothly out the window and into the frigid Manhattan skyline. Anna, only a breath behind the birds, lunges toward the open window, arm outstretched to grab the parrot, and knocks the empty champagne bottle from the ledge. It falls, forever and ever, only to disintegrate on the sidewalk below, 20 feet from the nearest pedestrian, in a cloud of powdered glass. When she lifts her eyes again, the first bird, her Janus, is little more than a green smudge against the horizon, while the second is lying stunned at her feet, one wing bent at an awkward angle.
It is freezing on the rooftop. Anna has no idea how she's lost her coat, and really she doesn't care. Janus is out there in the cold somewhere, winging her way across the skyline in the dark, cold dead of night. So why should Anna be warm? Why should she be so lucky? She screams the bird's name over and over as she leans across the ledge, her bare skin pressed against the brick, and her voice growing hoarser by the moment. An echoing chorus of Janus's bounces off the buildings. The bird does not return, but the neighbors scream at her to shut the ever-loving hell up. Anna does not comply. Compliance is not in her nature. Another bottle of champagne, the last from her room, sits half-empty beside her, and she takes a pull from its long, slender neck. The bubbles do nothing to warm her, but they help her forget she's cold. She is babbling and incoherent now, beside herself. The only reason Anna knows someone has come to collect her is because the coat is dropped over her shoulders, cutting off the wind. Arms around her like a vice. The scrape of concrete on her heels as she's dragged across the roof and toward the door, cursing and muttering in her ear. The heiress's enraged shriek somewhere off to the side. Anna reaches for her bottle, but her arm weighs 1,000 pounds and will not cooperate. A stairwell. The thump of limbs against steps as she's guided down. Warmth. The penthouse. Her bed. A horrendous banging as someone nails the window shut. The slamming of her bedroom door. Darkness.
Chapter 14. Anastasia. Under arrest, on Freedom Street. 1917. Tobolsk, Russia. October 10th. The glare makes me wince, but I cannot protest or move seats because Pierre Gilliard is in one of his moods. I can see it written there on his furrowed brow, in his clouded eyes. His long limbs snap with quick, jerky movements. His fingers drum incessantly on his desk and then on the chalkboard. Our tutor has grown increasingly anxious since his arrival in Tobolsk. And though Gilliard is only in his late 30s, he frets like an old man. Tatiana insists that he is only cranky because he's frightened for us. And this strict, unrelenting dictatorship in the classroom gives him a sense of control over our deteriorating circumstances. Olga believes he is simply humorless and doesn't know how to be anything but a curmudgeon. Both of them are proud of their observations and have taken to discussing them as we lie in bed at night. How worldly they consider themselves to be, how wise and studied in the nature of men. For the most part, I think they just like the sound of their own voices, and I wish they would be quiet and go to sleep. "Sit still," Maria says, driving her elbow into my ribs, "or you'll get us all in trouble." Maria cannot see Gleb Botkin sitting on the stone wall at the edge of the yard, nor can she see the shard of mirror in his hand or the way he uses it to reflect the sunlight into my eyes. And they call me Shribsik. He's the imp, blasted little troublemaker. Gleb and his sister, Tanya, arrived in Tobolsk in mid-September after being summoned by their father. The turmoil in Petrograd has made him uneasy, and he wants them close at hand. So they stay with Dr. Botkin in his rented rooms several blocks away. Although they are not allowed to visit us, they often come to the governor's house and eat their lunch on the wall and wait to catch a glimpse of our family. Sometimes they wave or dance to get our attention when they see us in the yard. Often I see Gleb searching the windows, looking for me, I think, in that innocent, puppyish way of his. Normally, the distraction is welcome, appreciated even. I can't fault his loyalty or enthusiasm. But Gleb has chosen a poor method of getting my attention today. I would throw open the window and scold him if I wasn't worried that I would get my knuckles wrapped by Gilliard. Gleb has been at it for half an hour, and my eyes are sore, so I close them. But even with my eyes squeezed tight, I can feel the bright little flashes of light, as though someone is turning an electric torch on and off again and again, an inch from my face. What I do not see, however,
is the look of exasperation on Pierre Gilliard's face, so it is a shock when he crosses the room and brings his ruler down firmly on the knuckles of my right hand. I yelp and jerk my hand away.
Why did you do that?
No sleeping in class, Anastasia.
His lips press into a tight, thin line.
I wasn't sleeping.
Do not lie, child. I saw you myself.
I was trying to rest my eyes.
I hate the way my voice pitches higher when I'm angry, how hysterical I sound. Gilliard laughs, but there is nothing kind or amused in the sound.
Resting your eyes from what, precisely?
He asks.
Him.
I point to where Gleb ought to be, where he was only minutes earlier.
Gleb was reflecting sunlight at me with a mirror.
The wall, of course, is empty, and that little green-eyed troll is nowhere to be seen. I'll throttle the boy with my bare hands the next time I see him. Pierre Gilliard clasps his hands behind his back and leans over the table.
It is unbecoming of a Tsarevna to make up stories just to get out of Latin.
I clench my teeth. I am not lying.
There was no one on the wall, Anastasia. There was no one distracting you. You were napping in class. You were being lazy.
I'm not lying, and I'm not lazy.
It's unfair of him to accuse me of this. I think he knows it too because he winces a little. The problem with having a temper is that my body often moves faster than my mind. It's far too easy to react with action instead of intellect. I don't realize that I've slammed my fist down on the table in fury until pain radiates from the bottom of my pinky up through the heel of my hand. I cannot keep my stupid, traitorous tears at bay, so I press my hand to my chest and scowl at Gilliard. Maria sits to my left, and I can feel her stiffen as he looms over me.
Stop, she hisses. You're only making it worse.
Gilliard's voice is calm and quiet, and I should be more frightened than I am. He reaches into his pocket, draws out a piece of chalk, and places it carefully on the table in front of me.
To the chalkboard, he says. The ablative case is characterized by three broad uses. You will write an example of each use in your best handwriting, along with their definitions and parts of speech. Prove to me that you were not napping, Anastasia.
I push back my chair, stand slowly, and pick up the chalk with two fingers. The schoolroom is silent as Alexei and my sisters stare at me in dismay. I snap the chalk in half and throw it against the wall.
I hate Latin!
Gilliard, even calmer now, draws another piece of chalk from his pocket and sets it before me.
Then your hate is misplaced, Tsarevna. I am not your enemy, and if you will not learn temperance under my tutelage, I fear you will learn it in other, harsher ways. But your punishment stands. The three uses of the ablative case, on the board, now.
Or what? I hiss. What will you do if I refuse?
You should have just done what Gilliard asked, Maria says, setting the bucket on the ground with one hand while she covers her nose with the other. She stands inside the kitchen door, unwilling to cross the threshold into the frozen yard.
You got us both in trouble.
Don't blame me. I didn't force you to interfere. I step aside as Jimmy bolts through the door and into the yard. The chickens run, squawking in terror, but I don't call him off. Jimmy won't hurt the stupid little birds, and they deserve a good fright.
Ugh!
Maria stomps her foot.
You can be such an ungrateful pest. Be glad Father didn't agree to Gilliard's original suggestion, or you'd be cleaning the soldiers' bathroom upstairs. Gilliard should be the one getting punished. He wrapped my knuckles for no reason.
I lift the bucket with a grunt and watch as the ghastly contents send white ribbons of steam into the air. He may as well work for the provisional government.
Shh, don't say that, Maria hisses. He's here, isn't he? And he's terribly loyal to Father. That alone puts him at risk. He's just trying to do his job. You weren't making it very easy for him, telling stories and all. It wasn't a story.
I set the bucket of kitchen slops at my feet. It's heavier than it looks, and the handle cuts into my sore hand. I have no idea how I'll carry the thing all the way to the refuse pit at the far end of the yard.
Gleb was out there, being a little scourge. This is all his fault.
Maria steps backward into the kitchen and shakes her head.
You have to stop looking for trouble, Shripsik. We have enough as it is.
She kicks the door shut with her foot, leaving me to finish the nauseous chore by myself. I can't look at the contents of the bucket without gagging, so I lift it in both hands and begin shuffling across the yard to where the chickens scratch and peck at the contents of the refuse pit. It wasn't long after our arrival in Tobolsk that I realized chickens are, in fact, the most odious animals ever created. They are loud and mean, not to mention horribly stupid, and yet ridiculously proud, squawking like harpies every time they lay an egg. They molt, they defecate everywhere, and the stuff is like tar, impossible to scrape from your shoes or your skin, and the smell is enough to make your eyes water. Their mating is so horrific and loud and violent, I am stunned the species has survived. I had the great misfortune of witnessing the act one afternoon when I drew the short straw, none of us would volunteer, and went to collect the eggs for cook. The rooster had that poor hen pinned to the ground, her wings flailing helplessly as he ripped feathers from her head and pounded her until she couldn't walk. I asked Father later, with burning cheeks, whether the hen had been raped. He assured me that no, it was just the way chickens went about their business. I, for one, thought it very unfair to the hen, and I had named the rooster Djavol, devil. The hens aren't his only victims, however. That evil little red-feathered monster launches himself at us whenever we gather eggs, and we live in fear of his vicious spurs. So I give the chicken coop a wide berth as I struggle with the bucket, muttering about my punishment. I have to stop every few minutes to move my skirt out of the way, lest I trip over my own hem and end up covered in refuse.
Do you need help with that?
Thomas stands behind me, hands stuffed deep in his coat pockets, trying not to laugh. His hair is too long, and his military cap too big, but he still looks charming, cute even. I can feel an unfamiliar heat rising in my cheeks, so I set the bucket down and look away from him.
Yes, please. It's very heavy.
Thomas peers into the bucket and curls his lip in distaste.
Entrails?
Disgusting, isn't it?
He leans in a bit closer.
And feathers? So...
Cook is roasting chickens for dinner tonight. These are the extra parts. I'm pretty sure that grey blobby thing is a gizzard. I shudder. Pity he didn't pull Djavol from the coop. I wouldn't mind seeing his gizzard in a bucket.
Djavol?
The rooster.
The corner of Thomas's mouth turns up in a grin.
That bad?
He's the spawn of Satan, and...
I hold up one finger as Thomas lifts the bucket and we begin walking toward the far corner of the yard. He's a cannibal as well. Just watch when we dump this out. He'll come running. Little monster loves nothing more than gobbling up his friends.
All chickens are cannibals, Thomas says. They'll eat anything. They're worse than pigs.
The back portion of the yard slopes downhill slightly, and we walk in silence as Thomas balances the bucket carefully in one hand, trying to make sure the revolting contents don't slosh over the edge and onto his boots.
How did you end up with this chore?
He asks when we reach our destination.
Haven't you heard? I am belligerent, quarrelsome, and incorrigible.
Then I am glad to have made your acquaintance. That's the only sort of person I associate with,
Thomas says.
You might want to look away for this part.
For once, I don't argue. I wander off a few feet and keep my back to Thomas as he tips the bucket over and sends the contents sliding into the pit. I can hear the wet, splattering sound, and I gag despite my determination not to. I squeeze my eyes tight and draw in several long breaths of frigid air through my nose to regain control of my roiling stomach. A short temper and an easy gag reflex. My list of flaws grows by the day. Jimmy has abandoned the chickens in favor of something at the wall. He's digging furiously at a small mound of frozen dirt. His tail lashes back and forth, and he grunts, desperate to reach whatever quarry lies hidden in the soil. A mole, no doubt, or some other small rodent.
So, who did you upset?
Thomas asks. He holds the empty bucket in his other hand, the one farthest from me, and leads the way back to the house.
Gilliard. Your tutor?
I nod. He called me a liar. I didn't take it very well. Thomas casts a sideways glance at me, and I think he smiles.
I can't imagine you would.
I offer him a curtsy and a wry smile. My reputation precedes me, I see.
Not at all.
I question him with a glance.
Observation, he says. You are different from your sisters. More spirited.
A polite word for poorly behaved.
I like to think it means interesting.
A good answer. I flash him a bright smile, and I'm rewarded with one from him. But that doesn't mean I believe you. I call, and Jimmy comes running, but not to me. He goes directly to Thomas, and receives a scratch between the ears as a reward. I glare at Thomas, but he laughs, and we tromp back toward the house. It is very strange to befriend a boy whose job it is to keep you under lock and key. Yet Thomas doesn't feel like a captor. He's not an officer. He has never ordered us around like Semyon or Leshy. He is simply there, constantly in the background, patrolling the yard or playing cards with the others upstairs. He often helps cook in the kitchen. He isn't stupid. Cook frequently hands out samples. Or walks Joy when Alexei is too weak to go outside. The boredom that afflicts us torments the guards as well. And as time goes on, the lines between us have begun to blur. These days, we barely notice the uniforms. Maria apparently doesn't notice the uniforms at all, because when I pull open the kitchen door, Thomas on my heels, I find her in the hallway between the kitchen and the pantry, partially hidden in shadow, whispering with a guard. In the seconds before the cold blast of wind hits her cheeks and she notices our presence, I see the way she looks at him. Not just flirtatious, but adoring. He leans close, one forearm resting on the wall above her head, their faces inches apart. They pull away quickly, fluidly, and if I hadn't seen the way her lips were parted and how round her eyes were, I might have believed her when she says, "No, I can manage quite well on my own, thank you." Maria turns and saunters away, chin up, shoulders stiff, as though she is offended rather than tempted. The guard, too, is gone, up the stairs, before I can say anything to him. Thomas stands behind me, bucket still in hand, and I know by his expression that I'm not mistaken. The look on his nicely angled face is one of revelation, as though he didn't know such a thing was possible. A soldier and a Tsarevna. "What is his name?" I ask. There are so many guards, and I know so few of their names.
"Ivan Skorohodov," he says.
Do I need to worry about my sister? Thomas lifts a hand slowly and then, after drawing a deep breath, as though to summon a bit of courage, brushes one finger along my chin.
No more than you need to worry about yourself.
2 weeks later. Tobolsk, Russia. October 25th. Don't you think it's ironic that we live on Freedom Street, yet we're under house arrest? Maria asks. We stand at the corner of the yard, peering up at the battered street sign. Freedom is a word I no longer know, I say. Don't let Gilliard hear you say that. He'll have you writing vocabulary cards in Latin all morning. Gilliard, I groan. He hates me. He does not hate you. Maria argues. He is trying to civilize you. He told me to shut up in class this morning. And to be fair, you talk too much. And you were being rather dreadful. Well, you would be dreadful too if he'd written those notes on your paper. We continue walking slowly through the yard. The wind bites our noses and earlobes, but we take our time. Once back inside, we will resume Gilliard's mind-numbing history lesson on the Samoyedic people group of Western Siberia. He said that I am lazy in my lessons, and that I am ill-mannered. But you are, Maria grins, showing there is no malice in the jab. No, I'm bored.
We're all bored, Schwibzik. It's no excuse to be a pest in the classroom.
The boredom is something we all deal with in different ways. There are endless games of dominoes and bezique and whist. We read all the books we brought with us from Saskoye Selo, and then we read them again. I've just gone through Ivanhoe for the third time, and I think I might lose my mind if I have to spend one more day in medieval England. We write in our journals, we write letters, we write terrible poems and short stories. Last week, Alexei declared he was going to write a novel, but never got more than a page or two into his swashbuckling pirate adventure before stopping to illustrate one of the pages. Then he gave up altogether. Meanwhile, Olga and Tatiana retreat into their books and needlework. Mother knits and unravels and knits again, or she works on the corsets. Father, unable to curb his need for physical exercise in any other way, has taken to spending hours each day chopping wood in the yard. He is so obsessed with the activity, in fact, that Leshy sent in great piles of birch trunks from a local sawmill for him to chop. Maria has found a more troublesome way of diverting her boredom. She flirts. We finish our final lap and turn back toward the house, when I catch her smiling at Ivan Skorohodov. Is that why you offered to keep me company during this forced exercise? I thought you were just being nice. I don't know what you're talking about. Yes, you do. I see the way you look at him. What's his name, anyway? And don't pretend like you don't know. I want her to admit it. I want to hear her say it out loud. Oh, you're one to talk. I see the way you flirt with Thomas. I do not flirt with Thomas. He is only a friend. So you can make friends with the guards, but I can't. I'm cold now, well and truly cold, and I rub my hands together as we hurry up the front steps and into the house. Don't be ridiculous, I whisper. We are all friends with the guards. The fact that I have a strong preference for Thomas is not something I admit, however. We pull off our hats and gloves and shrug out of our long coats and return to the schoolroom, where we expect to spend several excruciating hours at our lessons. Pierre Gilliard is there, along with the rest of our family, and all the staff. Oh no, I groan. Am I to be punished publicly? I've already apologized to Gilliard, and I've taken a walk. I really didn't—
Schwibzik, Father says, sit down. We've had news from Petrograd.
Maria grabs my hand as we drop into our seats. What news? I ask.
The Bolsheviks have taken control of the government.
What does that mean?
It is a second revolution,
Mother says. I still don't understand what it means.
To begin with, it means that Alexander Kerensky is no longer there to protect us,
Father says. If he had said that Satan was our benefactor and hell our actual home, he would not have received a louder outburst. The litany of Kerensky's sins against us begins. Father patiently endures this for a moment before raising his hand.
The man is no friend of mine, he says, but we might all be dead if not for him.
The fact that Father has mellowed in his opinion of Kerensky only makes me angrier. Alexei will never forgive Kerensky for what he did to the elephant, much less consider him a hero.
He killed Sammy, he protests.
Yes.
Father kneels before Alexei and takes his small, frail hands in his large, callous ones.
Sometimes mercy is severe.
Do not defend that monster, Mother says.
I do not defend him. I am only trying to explain that I understand now what he has done, why he has sent us here.
I hated Alexander Kerensky from the moment I saw him. Hated how he treated us, how he took every precious thing from us, how he took such delight in demoralizing us. To hear Father justify any of his actions feels like a betrayal.
And is this a mercy too?
I demand. This muddy hell that we've been forced into?
Do not curse, Schwibzik. It is unbecoming of you.
I'm not cursing. Hell is a location, a noun. I say, looking at Gilliard, and I am gratified to see that he is struggling not to grin.
Father chooses not to fight that particular battle. Do not forget, child, that there is a great deal of difference between